Welcome to the Bete Bora podcast. Bete Bora is a European network of Jewish women. We offer a platform for international exchange of feminist ideas. We talk with Jewish women about their aims, their activities, and their achievements. With this, we want to make women more visible and strengthen their position in society in general and in the Jewish world. Hello, listeners. Welcome to our Bete Bora podcast. I'm Nolly Lappin-Eppel talking to you from Vienna. But today's guest is very, very far away from me in Chicago. It's Sandy Weisenberg, who has attended most, if not all, our Bete Bora conferences. So some of you might know her. Sandy Weisenberg was born and raised as a fourth generation Texan. Today, as I mentioned, she lives in Chicago. Sandy has an MFA in fiction from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop and a BSJ from the Medill School of Journalism at Northwestern University. She was a feature writer for the Miami Herald and has published prose and poetry in the New Yorker, Plowshares, Narrative, Prairie Schooner, New England Review, Michigan Quarterly Review, Colorado Review, and many other places. For 10 years, she was co-director of Northwestern's then MA/MFA in Creative Writing Program and was a graduate faculty recipient of a Distinguished Teacher Award. She has been the literary editor of Tri Quarterly, the creative nonfiction editor of another Chicago magazine, and today she's the editor of this journal. Sandy has published a number of books, the short story collection, The Sweetheart is In, an essay collection, Holocaust Girls, History, Memory, and Other Obsessions, and a nonfiction chronicle, The Adventures of a Cancer Bitch. In March 2023, Sandy published the collection of essays, The Wandering Womb, which we will discuss soon. For this work, she was awarded the Juniper Prize for Creative Nonfiction. This is by no means the only prize she has received, but I will leave it at that and turn to my distinguished guest. Congratulations, Sandy, for the success of your latest book.
Thank you, Norli. It's thrilling to be talking to you.
The Wandering Womb is a collection of essays that belongs to different genres. Some are autobiographic, some essays are on Freud, and different series about the nature of women through the ages. What made you choose this form? Was this mixture not quite risky?
The mixture? I didn't think about it. Basically, somebody said to me, oh, you just got a bunch of old essays and just put them together in a book. And I was like, oh, no, of course not. But that's really what I did. I've been publishing a lot of individual pieces. Some were strictly essays, some were more autobiographical pieces, some were more memoiristic. And I wanted to make a book, and I just had to figure out which ones to keep, which ones not to use, and then how to put them together. I didn't put them together in chronological order. That seemed, I don't know if that was too easy, but I sort of arranged them. So I hope they're talking to each other. So I hope that there's some rhythm, and some are kind of funny and some are not as funny. I think most of them have a little bit of humor. Some are more researched and some are less researched. And I present myself in different ways, as young, as older. And it's not a traditional memoir. I think that's what you're responding to too. In a traditional memoir, I think I would have had more about why I don't have children, but instead I've kind of mentioned it here and there. That's one example.
Well, you could also say that in a way, for me, the red thread is also the kind of reflection on being a woman and being seen as a woman. And I think that this really connects the different essays. What would you say is your red thread?
It would be almost exactly that. It's really like what it's like to live in a woman's body with an awareness of history, which is mostly always there, not always there.
Yes. You are proud fourth-generation Texan. However, in this book, you try to reconnect to your ancestors' home in Russia, in Europe. Mm-hmm. What did Texas and Europe mean to you?
What does Europe mean to me? Remember when I was little, I didn't know what Europe was. I knew there were different countries, but I didn't know they were all Europe till I was about 8. And maybe when I was even younger, a cousin of ours came to stay with us for the summer. And he had been traveling in Europe, I think the summer before. And people said, where are you from? He said, Oklahoma. And they said, where's that? And he said, it's near Texas. And they said, oh, that's a bad place. That's where Kennedy was shot. So that's what Europe thought of Texas in the 60s. I don't know, like a lot of Americans, it just seemed like Europe is better. It's got more history. It doesn't tear things down as much. It's more civilized, which is an odd thing to say considering I read about Hitler and the Holocaust. There's just more there. But the strange thing about history is, I mean, and Europe, I can feel very connected to Europe and very connected to European history, but sometimes when I'm there, it's hard to believe that something happened there. I wrote about visiting Auschwitz, and it was just hard to imagine people there in the numbers, just thousands and thousands and thousands of people or millions passing through. So it's a paradox.
Well, this gets me to the next question. You relate quite strongly to places. This became clear at our Beta Bora conferences, where your presentations frequently had to do with the places we were in. I fondly remember your reading of texts of Rosa Luxemburg that she wrote in prison in Wroclaw while we were standing in front of the very prison. So what does place and history mean for you? I mean, places are important. They seem to resonate.
Yeah, I think places are important. I love reading plaques. I like to make up designs in my head to commemorate things that aren't commemorated. But even at the same time, while I was standing there across the street, it was still hard for me to imagine Rosa Luxemburg was really there. I knew she was there. I knew she had been there. And I was reading her letters and her letters, not her journal. But it was hard for me to believe it. I think it's intellectual versus emotional or something.
And yet it seemed to me that you were impersonating her. You even put on an old-fashioned blouse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And in a way you acted. Yes? It did not just read. So it's strange to hear that it didn't work for you. It worked for us.
Oh, well, maybe that's the point.
Yeah.
It works for other people. I also, at a Modern Language Association conference, I pretended to be Emma Lazarus. And I wrote about her visit to England to see William Morris. He was a socialist and a designer. And I bought some earrings that I thought were old-fashioned. And I was thinking, can these earrings be tax deductible? Because I'm using them in a presentation, but of course I wasn't getting paid and I didn't try to claim them on my taxes.
You attended most of the Beta Bora conferences. What made you come from far away Chicago to different places in Europe? And what are the most blatant differences between Jewish women in the US and in Europe?
I became friends with Laura Demick in 1992. In Berlin, and I knew about this Beit Deborah from her. She was one of the founders. And after I got breast cancer, I thought, I'm going to travel more. And so I decided to come.
And then you said you came to all different
countries. To a bunch, yeah. It was really interesting. I learned so much. I learned what it was like to be a feminist, mostly academic Jewish woman in Europe. Not that they're all the same, but just how some of the people are. And I think the difference is between Americans and Europeans. We can be Jewish when we want to. And I mentioned this to you once. I said, I think only in America can you be a casual Jew. And you said also in Vienna, you can. So maybe it is kind of the same, but like Jews are always changing. They're like, yeah, I belong to the synagogue. Okay, now I'm going to belong to this one. Oh, I'm not going to do anything for the holidays this year. That's some Jews. I mean, some Jews are always consistent in their practice and their thinking. But I think Jews here don't have to think as much about being Jewish. Even with the rise of anti-Semitism, even with the murders in the Pittsburgh synagogue, I don't think it's as fraught here. And there are a few Jews here who grew up and didn't know they were Jewish, but that's not very common. And it's much more common among women I met through Beit Deborah, who grew up in Poland and maybe some other countries too. There's not an inherent fear in being Jewish, even though there was some anti-Semitism. I didn't feel it growing up. My parents felt it more, but it wasn't a constant day-to-day thing.
Yeah, it's much more present here, and it's also, yeah, it's much more part of the DNA of our societies in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a constant struggle, and it's a constant fear, I think. So what is your relationship to Europe? As an American, as a Jew, as a woman, you seem to have very mixed feelings.
I just think it's interesting. I can't quite call it the motherland because I've never been to the places in very far east Europe where my family's from. I feel that it shaped us. And by us, I guess I mean my family. It was funny, I did a reading recently and somebody said, oh, you grew up with so many languages, Lithuanian and Russian and blah, blah. I said, well, no, nobody in my family spoke Lithuanian. Nobody that I know of spoke Russian. They may have read Russian, people I didn't know. But they spoke Yiddish. But by the time I knew my grandparents, they barely spoke Yiddish. My grandmother knew some Yiddish. My grandfather didn't know any because he had been born in Texas. I'm the worst Yiddish student, I think, in the entire world. I took Yiddish classes for several years here, and I was never very good at speaking. I could read it, and then after a while, I just stopped. And I envy people, especially my friends who speak Yiddish and have been translating. And at the time, I felt that was a connection to my ancestors. And I like being able to think, oh, these sentences or phrases, they were probably things they were thinking. Like I have a scene in my book where my uncle remembers that after the war, somebody came over to their town in South Texas and was just reporting on where all the family was. And he said, everybody, you know, he would say a name and he would say dead. And so I imagine he would say the name and it would say murdered. And I imagine he would be speaking in Yiddish, which I assume he was. And that made me feel a little closer to the experience.
Well, after all, you're a fourth generation Texan. I personally am only a second generation Austrian. So we always see America as the big melting pot where all the immigrants live. But in a way, this is a fairly consolidated society that you come from.
Yeah, I mean, I'm only fourth generation through that one grandfather. Through my other grandfather, I'm a third generation Texan. So I'm not pure fourth generation. My great grandfather was born somewhere in East Europe, but he lived most of his life in Dallas. He was a blacksmith and he had a blacksmith shop next to his house.
So now let's turn to something very different. Let's turn to your book. In this book, we were already talking about the honesty in your book, which I find very impressive, but it's a big charm of the book, you know, this honesty. You know, there's a woman talking about her life, herself, her feelings. While working in Florida, you got involved with a group of feminists and wished to become a lesbian. You failed because you are attracted to men. But you point out that you love these women. What kind of love is this?
Maybe it's aspirational. Maybe it was because, I mean, now when people think of Miami, I guess they think of it as it's like a real happening place and there's so much culture. But when I was there, it was very, very conservative. The most of the politicians were Cuban. They would have some sort of display of chained nations, and they would be representing nations that were under Soviet bloc. This was still during the Cold War. And I had come from the University of Iowa, where there were tons of feminists, and people would talk about Cuba as this great place. You know, it was very universal education and health. We were fighting Nestle. We were boycotting Nestle because they were getting women not to breastfeed and giving them a formula that wasn't good for the child. I was just involved in all these activities, pro Sandinista, anti-Ronald Reagan, anti-nuclear war. And then when I got to Miami, it was like cold water in my face. It was like things I thought were normal were not normal. Like when former President Jimmy Carter came to speak at a bookstore, there were bomb threats because he was too liberal. So I just found these women, and it was like, they would talk about not shaving their legs. And it was, wow, this is just like Iowa. You know, these are my people. And they were so earnest. I remember we went to this place called The Land. I don't know if people bought it or what. It was going to be some kind of utopian retreat. And we were defining ourselves. And we said, we're this, we're that, we're Jews. You know, and somebody said, we have to say we're Ashkenazi Jews because there are no Sephardic Jews here, and we need to be specific, and we don't want people to think it's, you know, we're just not mentioning them or something, you know. So they were very, very sincere and earnest and believed in equality. And I just connected with them so much. And they were just such interesting people, and they thought a lot. And most of my other friends were at the newspaper, and they were smart, but they thought more about the moment at hand. And I think these people were maybe a little more utopian.
However, your description of your youth in Texas was also not a very progressive society or feminism. You know, when you talk about the big mistake you made, not to let a boy kiss you. Yes, that on one hand, everybody seemed to admire you, but you knew in Texas this was a mistake. So what's the difference between Texas and Florida?
They were years apart. They were maybe 20-something years apart, or I guess I was 26 when I went to Florida and 18 when I left Chicago, left Houston. Houston was very traditional. I think a lot of America was very traditional in the 60s. I mean, that's a strange thing to say, considering that's when there was revolution, more or less here, cultural revolution. I was a little too young to be part of that. And I regret that I spent my youth reading stupid books. I mean, I read a lot as a kid, and then there was this feeling that girls were not supposed to be smart, and you weren't supposed to read, and you were supposed to be shopping all the time and getting your hair cut and putting on makeup. And in school, you could order some books through this little catalog they gave you. And I ordered these books about dating and talking to boys and fixing your hair and what kind of makeup you should wear. And a friend and I would cut out pictures from magazines, these teen magazines, and you know, what kind of clothes we should wear and what colors and all this minutia. And it's like, oh my God. And I even read this book called How to Get a Teenage Boy and What to Do with Him When You Get Him. And it didn't work. It was a popular book. The woman who wrote it was Jewish. She died later of breast cancer. So as much as you think about Jewish women like Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem or behind the women's movement, there were still some smart Jewish women who were still going with the program.
Yeah. Could you tell us something about Jewish life in Texas, in Houston?
It was very normal. I mean, and maybe everywhere you grow up, you think, oh, this is normal. But it was normal to go to synagogue for somebody's bar mitzvah. If you were a good friend of that person, you would be part of the bar mitzvah, like being part of a wedding. And you would get a corsage and serve punch. Or everybody would have marchers. And they would march you down the aisle as you went up to the bima. And you'd also get a corsage. And that was just normal, right? You know, because and two people would get bar bat mitzvah every week because there was such a baby boom. And there were five synagogues. I had the feeling I knew most of the Jewish families. I'm sure I didn't. But if I met somebody Jewish, my parents probably knew them. It seemed to me that everybody's parents or everybody's father had fought in World War II. And they ran a family business that the grandfather had started. That wasn't always true. And most people were, it seemed a lot of people were from Eastern Europe. I didn't feel the German Jew versus East European Jew divide that had been very strong a generation before. In fact, there was a synagogue in Houston that was anti-Zionist. It was very German Jewish. It was anti-Zionist. And this is in the 40s. After the Holocaust, I don't know how long afterwards they changed their stance, but you could not be a voting member if you were pro-Zionist. But I didn't know this. I didn't feel it. It didn't trickle down.
So was the mood Zionist in Houston, in the synagogues?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There would be an American flag and an Israeli flag, you know, because Jews are always being, you know, accused of being, you know, not patriotic enough, right? So you have to have the American flag. I think in the prayer book, there was a prayer for Israel, the state of Israel. People responded to attacks and wars in Israel, gave a lot of money. There was something called the Federation, which the Jewish Federation, which collected money for the community and for Israel. I mean, it's still there.
I understand that you were not in an Orthodox community.
Conservative. Yeah. And I think conservative in Texas may have been looser than in other parts of the country. It was a really big synagogue. It was just accepted that we would be bat mitzvahed. But it was also accepted that we wouldn't read from the Torah. And it was just one of those things. Oh, yeah. Well, that's what girls read the Haftorah. And my aunt was a feminist and she thought girls should read from the Torah. And so my cousin would probably in 72 or so, or 73, she was the first girl to read from the Torah at our synagogue. And some older men walked out.
That's interesting. So you are very deeply connected to Judaism. And I also think that you're deeply connected to Jewish learning. And still in your book, you also talk about the problems you have with Jewish tradition. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about this?
I had an opportunity to go to the mikveh. And there was just one mikveh around here at the time. And I went with friends. And we thought, there were two of us, we thought that our third friend had invited us to go with her. But she remembered that she didn't invite us, that we wanted to go with her. So my friend and I went, and we were just like, I guess we were in our 30s, and we were feeling like we weren't the real Jews that this was for. This is really for Orthodox Jews, and we're not really that religious. And we're just looking around, and we felt self-conscious. I'm looking down at my fingernails. This woman, you know, she inspected us to see if our fingernails were clean, which felt very much like what you hear about boarding school and Dickens or something. And we felt, oh, this is meaningful for other people, not for us. And I had had a little biopsy on my breast, and there was still a little scar, little stitches and little piece of tape. And the mikveh lady had to get permission from the rabbi for me to still go in. And we went in, and it was kind of interesting. You know, we said the prayer and dunked, but I didn't feel anything. And my friend is a lesbian, my friend who went with me, and she was kind of nervous that they would discover she was a lesbian and run her out. But the woman who originally went, whose idea it was, she really got something from it. And since then, in the suburbs of Chicago, there's one of the new wave kind of mikvahs where it's not so Orthodox. And this is just hearsay. I haven't ever gone there. And people can use it for their own purposes, like if they're getting a divorce and they want to, you know, renew, or if they've had surgery or they are grieving. And I think that's nice, but I started reading about the mikveh, and I still can't get over the fact that men think women's bleeding is so bizarre and dirty, you have to have all these rules about it.
This whole thing with ritual cleanliness is, of course, a very strong weapon against women.
Mm.
You know, it really opens the door to discrimination. Yeah, when you have the gender-segregated buses in Israel, the same gender-segregated clinics, and the women are always sitting in the back because they might be impure. So this really has become a weapon.
You're right. You're right. I went to St. Yortzeit for my father several years ago. There was just one synagogue nearby that did the services at night on a weeknight. And so I went, and I knew it was Orthodox, but I knew everybody loved the rabbi. So I thought, well, maybe he's kind of loose. But still, I had to sit behind a mechitza. And at the end, the rabbi thanked the men for staying through the whole service so they would have a minyan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, hey, there's three of us back here. I know we don't count, you know, but can't you see us?
Yeah. And yet you're still deeply connected.
I am. I mean, I think of myself I think I'm part of this long line of Jewish people. And maybe that's partly my connection with Europe, or that my connection to Europe came from that I'm just aware of all the generations behind me, even though I don't know them. I don't know their names beyond, you know, an early point. I mean, I know my great-grandparents' names, and maybe great-great, but that's it. But I just think we come from a line of people. And of course, it goes back to Africa, where the first people came from. But in some ways, I'm tribal, I guess. Or everybody wants to be part of something. I mean, the synagogue I go to now operates out of a little church. And last time I went, they combined with another little synagogue or little congregation in a different little church. I don't know if people do that in Europe so much, but in the US, when congregations are starting out, it's not unusual to share a space with a church just because you're there on different days. It's not like it's rampant all over the country.
Well, I was one of the founders of the liberal community in Vienna, one and only liberal community. And we also started out in a Christian prayer room because the Protestants offered us this prayer room. We were looking for some room And we started out there, and when we had our services, we were running around hanging scarves on over the courses.
Right, exactly.
So of course, for the Orthodox, this was of course an argument against us. But we were very happy that we had a dignified room to pray. Mm-hmm. Big enough for the high holidays.
Yes.
Yes, and then after time, we found some other place. But yes, we started out, and it was a strong argument against us. At the time, we didn't feel, they also told us that this was not a church, this was a prayer room, and it has had some ecumenical flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So our hosts were very sensitive to our problems, and they reassured us. This didn't help us with the rest of the Jewish community, but we were reassured. Now, as we are talking about Vienna, of course, you also have a chapter about Vienna, which I liked a lot. And there you compare the secret of menstruation, that you did not want to be discovered by your hosts, and the secret of being Jewish. Could you tell us more about these secrets?
I think it was a feeling of shame, like sometimes, you know, like I want to fit in and I want to please people. And maybe I'm less of that since I started on anti-anxiety and antidepressants. But I met this guy in Turkey, in Istanbul. We became friends. He was a little younger than I was. And he was from Vienna, not Jewish. I was the first Jewish person he'd ever seen in the flesh. He said there was a rabbi on TV. And I have found sometimes when you first meet people, you talk about these really deep things that you never talk about with them again. So we were talking about terrorism. Is it ever correct? You know, the Baader-Meinhof gang and all kinds of stuff. It was really interesting. And then I went to Vienna sometime later and I stayed with him. And he kept wanting to show me St. Stephen's Platz and, you know, is it the Schönbrunn?
Schönbrunn.
And everything, you know, Vienna stuff. And I had this vague notion of, I want to know about Jews and I want to go to the Jewish Welcome Center and I want to go to the Jewish Museum. And I just felt embarrassed to say it because he was so sure of what the tourist in Vienna should see.
The must-sees.
Yeah. And I mean, it seems silly now that I couldn't just say, oh, no, I don't want to see those, or I want to see this and this. And then at the same time, I was staying at his place, which he shared with his sister, but she was gone. And I just felt I didn't know him well enough to ask where I should throw my tampons. I was afraid they were too strong they were too big for the sewer system, and I didn't want to muck up his toilet. So I carry my tampons and napkins around, my pads around in a plastic bag, and just throw them away in a big garbage can whenever I saw it. And then when I went to Freud's apartment, I went to the bathroom, and it was like a beautiful bathroom. I don't know if you remember it, but it's this beautiful white tiled bathroom. And I thought, wow, you know, this is great, a great place to throw my used sanitary products. And then later I thought, what does a woman want is what Freud asked. And this is what she wants, a place to throw her unmentionables away. Even though as time has gone on in the past few years, there's more and more talk about menstruation. There's a movement to have sanitary products free in public restrooms. When I was at the university, no, it was the College of Charleston in South Carolina, in the Jewish Center, they were free. And at the Dallas airport in Texas, and there's fights for menstrual equity. Like, they're considered in the sales tax structure, some states, menstrual products are considered cosmetics. and they're taxed that way and not health products.
Mm-hmm. So it's less of a secret today.
Yes, I think so.
And when you travel to Europe now, is being Jewish a secret, or are you more assertive about this?
When I travel now?
In Europe.
In Europe.
Germany, Austria.
Maybe that was a nice thing about being with Beit Deborah people. It's like you could be Jewish with the people you're with. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone makes a big deal about being Jewish, like during dinner at a restaurant when there are four people. But maybe that, so I'm thinking about it, but not feeling uncomfortable about it. But I think Jews, especially American Jews of a certain age, kind of like to frighten themselves. And I'm not sure if this is in the book, but I was at a youth hostel. I don't know if it was in Vienna. I was with somebody and she says, we're using the showers. And so, you know, because there were concentration and extermination camps, basically, with Jews went to the showers. And so you have a little frisson of, you know, there but for the date I was born and the place I was born, go I.
So still ambivalent. But as we talk about Vienna, this, of course, brings me to your interest in Freud and in psychoanalysis. Could you tell us something about that?
I don't know when I first became interested in Freud. I think I became interested in him early as an opponent because feminists were attacking him, his thoughts, because he, first of all, he believed in the vaginal orgasm and the clitoral orgasm was immature. And then the other was so many young women were telling them that their father had molested them. And he was like, oh, this can't be so. So it's got to be their fantasy. And feminists of the second wave were saying, no, it was probably true. So maybe that's how I got interested in him. And interested in him because he had such an impact. Just day to day, people say, oh, I'm very anal. And nobody thinks about this is something Freud came up with. Sometimes people don't really talk about superego and id so much anymore. But I know it's very interesting to me. Let me go backwards. Also, it was very interesting to me that a Jewish man in the very late 19th century and early-ish 20th century was so important to the whole culture. And I found out about Bertha Pappenheim, who had been Anna O, who wasn't even Freud's Anna O. It was Josef Breuer's Anna O. And they wrote Breuer and Freud wrote a book together about psychoanalysis, and she was, her case study was in there. And Breuer's analysis in there was, here's this woman, she's upper middle class, she's kind of bored, she just speaks strange languages, she won't get out of bed. And then he would talk to her and listen to her for days, like every day he would listen to her. And he said something like, I don't think any two people could be so close as we were. And then he left and got married. And then she had an attack and said, I'm having Dr. B's baby. But that turned out to be wrong, that Freud had just added that for emphasis and drama. But there was something kind of wrong with her. And it could be she was just bored and came up with these symptoms. I don't know. And she was treated later in her life in sanatoriums. And then she became a Jewish feminist activist. And once Ernest Jones, who was Freud's biographer, outed her, I think in the 1950s, and she'd already been dead, and said that she was Bertha Pappenheim and Anna O, they put the two together. it became very interesting because we have one person's inner life as told by someone else, and then one person's outer life as told by someone else. And how do you put these two together? So I tried to do a lot with Bertha. I tried to make a play. I just didn't know. I couldn't figure out how to do something with her, what kind of structure to use. So then I put her in the Wandering Womb essay. And Ty wrote about how she was taking care of her father in Bad Ischl, and she was staying up very late and waiting for a doctor to come. And she started seeing things before her eyes. The next day she saw death's heads and snakes. And then later on, I assume this maybe wasn't really strange. It seems strange to us. She was fighting sex traffic among Jews. Yeah. And you had a Protestant group that did this, a Catholic group that did this, and a Jewish group that did this. And so she ran around Europe and beyond checking on Jewish prostitutes. And I don't know exactly what she was doing. I don't know if she was offering to help them, but she fixated on one of them. So I guess it was looking to how the other half lived, but she was also a feminist. She did things in the world. She had a school for fallen girls and poor girls that taught them how to have skills that they could use in the working world. I guess that's kind of how I got into Freud. I'm kind of interested in him as a gossip. You know, I'm more interested in whether he had an affair with his sister-in-law than all his like arcane theories. You know, I don't know.
A human touch.
Yes, the human touch.
In the United States, there seems to be a conservative turn that brings with it anti-women legislation. In Austria and Germany, we have similar tendencies. How can we protect our rights and the achievements of the past decades?
I think you just have to get people elected and go out into the streets. It's shocking to me, and I'm sure it is to you, that, you know, you think, I don't know, when I was growing up, I might hear somebody older who had gone to New York to get an abortion. And then you think, oh, okay, well, now anybody can get an abortion. Though I had gone to protest like maybe 20 years ago in front of, not really protest, but gatherings in front of abortion providers, buildings, and tried to fend off the people who were yelling at them, who were the anti-choice people yelling at them. It's shocking. And it's shocking also, it seems to me the speed, but it probably isn't speed, of this legislation. And in Texas, it just seems like any woman should be able to control her body. And it's all part of, you know, right-wing revanchism coming back, you know, right-wing, anti-woman, pro-family, pro-Christian evangelicalism, even though there are conservative Jews. You know, and I guess having been to Europe and reading about Europe, I can see things as maybe as you were saying too. You see, okay, it's not just happening in the US. You know, anti-immigrant, anti-woman, anti-gay legislation is just going on everywhere. And you have these dictators or wannabe dictators in Poland and Hungary, and you had Trump, and you got Netanyahu. I'm not sure where he is on abortion rights. I don't know if he has been public with an opinion. And maybe it's just the world that things go a certain way for a while, then they go backwards for a while, then they go forward for a while and backwards. I mean, for me and you, backwards is the same. But I mean, there are people in the 80s who thought it was terrible that all these performance artists were smearing chocolate on themselves. Well, I mean, it's just one. but are using urine in their art. And for them, it's maybe, wow, it's so great after these excesses in the culture, we have the family again. And women are, keep women in their place and girls in their place. And family is the most important thing.
And it's a terrible misuse of family because, you know, it's not a necessary juxtaposition. Successful women, professional women, and families. And we were so close to it. So what are your plans for the future? Let's not stop on this very sad ideas. What are your plans?
I started writing short stories in the voice of a woman who was born in 1910 and was a model at a department store in Berlin. And she, it's a, the premise is it's the 1980s and she's talking to an interviewer. So I published one of those stories and I started working on more stories about her. I felt I couldn't be really authentic telling a story in English, except if it's filtered through her like 40 years in the United States. Mm-hmm. I'm doing that. And now I've had a couple in her voice. And now I'm writing about her brother who was born in 1900 and spent 10 years in an orphanage in Berlin. And I just been doing research and found that there was an orphanage where there was, I don't know what you would call it, an emphasis on kibbutz. And I'm getting confused a bit between what I read and what I'm making up. But I think some of the people from the first kibbutz in Israel, Dagania, came and talked to people in a real orphanage. I'm not sure if, I'm pretty sure that's true, which is interesting to me.
Yes, there was Siegfried Lehmann, and he later on, he had these children's homes, not only children in Berlin, First World War, and then went to Israel and had this youth village.
So, yeah, yeah, I mean, yeah.
Make it up.
Okay, thank you. And communal living is just very interesting, I guess partly as I get older, but I've always been interested in it, never really experienced it. And it's the most ecological way to live. And there's, and Israel, which was such a pioneer in it in the 20th century, just has become less and less of a place for communal housing as the country has gotten richer and richer.
Well,
but Germany, you know, I knew someone I forgot what it was called, but she lived in this really big place and you didn't know which bed you were going to be sleeping in. And you would just go to the clothes pile and take out some clothes. But.
Well, in our youth, there used to be many experiments like this. Mm-hmm. A bit later. I think now it's a bit less experimental.
Right. Especially, I think, when people have children. Well, the kibbutz managed that. You know, they dealt with all the orphans from Europe.
Yeah.
By raising them together, and the people who had kids would, you know, go visit their kids and stay with their kids, or their kids would come stay with them.
Well, that's an interesting project you have here that you're working on, you know, between
Thanks.
Berlin and Israel and the United States. In a way, it's, yeah, it fits you. That's the way
yeah, I'm
to know you.
Yeah, well, I got a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, and I'm hoping to use it to go to Paris, Zurich, and Berlin. Zurich is the place where my character goes, and she ends up working with refugees. When Switzerland finally lets refugees in during World War II, she's working with them. And I think the whole notion of Switzerland and how it dealt with refugees is very interesting.
It is. Well,
yeah.
It's good to see that you're continuing.
Thank you.
Maybe we'll see again at one of the conferences.
Yeah, I hope so.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for reading the book and thinking about it.
I really enjoyed it. I really enjoyed it, and I really suggest that our listeners go and get the book. Goodbye, Sandy, and all the best.
Goodbye. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Thank you, listeners, for your interest. Our next Bete Borg podcast will come out in a month. Goodbye and stay well.